The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Author Events office, and tonight it is my great honor to welcome back Orhan Pamuk to the Free Library. The winner of the 2006 Nobel Prize in Literature, Turkish writer Orhan Pamuk is one of the greatest novelists of his generation, so-called by the Washington Post and too many other periodicals, magazines, and human beings to mention here. Characterized by examinations of identity, tensions between the East and West, modernism's clash with tradition, and a fascination with the creative arts, his novels, translated into more than 60 languages, include The New Life, Snow, The Museum of Innocence, A Strangeness in My Mind, and My Name is Red, which was the winner of the IMPAC Dublin Literary Award. Mr. Pamuk is also the author of several works of nonfiction, essays, memoirs, and screenplays. He joins us tonight with his latest book, Nights of Plague, part detective story, part historical epic, part contemporary political parable, with a touch of Borges thrown in there. This complex and intricately detailed novel follows the efforts of the residents of a fictional island belonging to the Ottoman Empire to halt the spread of a deadly illness. Mr. Pamuk is joined tonight in conversation with Laura McGrath. Her work has been published in a wide variety of academic journals, as well as The Atlantic, The Los Angeles Review of Books, and Public Books. She is one of the founding co-editors of the Post 45 Data Collective and is currently at work on a book titled Middlemen, Literary Agents and American Literature, which definitely sounds like something I'll enjoy reading. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming tonight's guests.
Hello, everyone. It's so wonderful to see so many of you here. So wonderful to welcome Orhan here to the Free Library. I believe, Orhan, you're going to open for us with a reading tonight.
This is a reading. Why don't I read something? And it's from my latest book, Nights of Plague. That's why I'm here. Happy to see you all here. This book is, this is from 210th page of a book that is, my God, I don't want to see it, 670 pages. Doctor, we have plague in an island, imaginary island, Ottoman island, in a distant, remote island of Ottoman Empire. It's an imaginary island because I just didn't want to focus on a place, didn't want to be busy with real local history. It's a general place, but it's made up of peculiarities of Ottoman Greek islands of Mediterranean. Most of these islands are Greek populated. So is Ireland. And there is plague there. We are in the middle of the plague, one third of the book. Dr. Nuri woke up before dawn. As he got dressed, he watched his sweetly sleeping wife and at the same time kept thinking that the rumors must be true, that the Governor Pasha must be planning to do what governors usually did in emergencies and execute Ramiz and his two henchmen without waiting for approval from the High Court in Istanbul. He walked down the stairs, followed by the respectful glances of the guards on night shift, and made instinctively for the inner courtyard. Most executions were carried out in the inner courtyards of government buildings, but there was nobody there. The overgrown sheepdog that was always tethered to the railings on the kitchen windows and barked relentlessly every night had vanished at the start of the plague outbreak. In the darkness, there was not even a single shadow to be seen. He walked past the columns of the domed gallery and felt like a ghost. As he slowly circled the square, he kept thinking that any moment now he would run into someone but the night was like a dark, two-dimensional room. No matter how many steps he took, he could not find his way out of that black box. But sometimes the shadow of a tree or a faded color would drift silently past him. He passed the quarantine notices and the shuttered shops, then turned into an alleyway and walked in the dark for a long time across the never-ending streets of the plague-ridden city. Okay.
So this book is Nights of Plague. It takes place during a plague, during a series of quarantines. And so as I was reading, and I'm sure as many of you were reading as well, so much of this novel felt so familiar, though it's also set in the distant island of Mingaria. But as I understand, you began writing this novel before coronavirus began. And so we have this confluence of events of your writing life and global events. Can you talk a little bit about the...
Yes, I've been thinking about this novel for 40 years. Then I've decided, I've read so much, that one thing that I learned that when this kind of pandemic happens, humanity repeats itself. In fact, I wrote an article about this in New York Times, that first there is denial, then the numbers go up, then there are rumors, gossip, things like, you know, Muslims bought it, Jews bought it, Christians bought it, bad guys bought it, the government bought it. Then again, the numbers go up. But then there is an inevitable demand from the people to from the government to stop it. Then another thing that I have learned and read from my readings, that the governments get authoritarian. And 5 years ago, in Turkey, Erdogan government was getting increasingly authoritarian. And I thought, wow, I've been, you know, reading books, thinking about this book for almost 40 years. It's a good time to start my allegorical historical novel about plague. Then 3.5 years after writing it, bling, another coronavirus pandemic took over. In fact, I was thinking about making this joke that the best books about plague are written by, I think, in the best one is Daniel Defoe's The Journal of the Plague Year, and the second one is Alessandro Manzoni's The Betrothed. It's a sort of an Italian War and Peace. And the third one is Albert Camus' Plague, because maybe it was also a political allegory. And I was going to say, well, when my book is published, I'm going to say, and humbly, I am the fourth one. These writers did never experience anything like plague or any pandemic. They based their books on other books. So I was going to say, my book is also like that, but unfortunately, I couldn't say it.
So other than ruining your punchline, how did the onset of the pandemic change the writing of the book?
Maybe I'll give you also another example. That one of my books is Snow, and 2 months before publishing it in Turkey, 9/11 happened. But there's a difference. Political Islam or political Islamic fundamentalism didn't start with 9/11, but for United States, it started then. And in fact, before that, there was a huge profile of Osama bin Laden in New Yorker. I thought it, so I thought people would think that I cooked up my novel in 2 months, so I deleted Osama bin Laden's in the book. And they were not major things, they were small things. Here, I maybe cut down some of the quarantine descriptions. This is how I change my novel. But one thing I realize that, in fact, my aunt died, you know, one of the first victims of coronavirus in Istanbul, and she was living 3 streets away from me. I'm a normal person, I was scared, but my characters were not scared as I was. In fact, plague kills 1 in 3, and you can never, if you get it, you die, while coronavirus is much more milder. 1 in 100 at the worst times were dying, and you can also, if you get the virus, you may stay alive. So I injected my fear to my characters. That was perhaps the only change I made.
You know, I was thinking, one of the more delightful aspects of this book, one of the things that I loved about this book, is the frame narrative. So we have a narrator at the beginning who is one part historian and one part novelist, and we learn more about her identity as the novel progresses. We learn a little bit about her sense of objectivity, or not, as the novel progresses as well. And, you know, she reflects at the beginning of the novel that this is both a historical novel and a history written in the form of a novel. And the novel's moving back and forth between these two modes as the narrator, Mina Minger, moves back and forth between these two modes. And so I was thinking about Henry James, and I was thinking about James and his belief about the inaccessibility of historical fiction, right? The impossibility of historical fiction, the inability for us to ever inhabit the mind.
He wrote that in a letter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's famous for me. Mm-hmm. I care about what he wrote. But he meant, by the historical novel, he meant medieval people. I think the sensibility of modern sensibilities was already in the book. But yes, the way of communication is really a telegraph. But on the other hand, in Daniel Defoe's time, it was no communication between, and more important was illiteracy. But on the other hand, I was not too much upset by the fact that this is a historical novel. What's the relevancy? I had friends who were saying, Orhan, who would read your esoteric subject? What is quarantine? Who would know that? The same friends later called me to say that I was lucky. While, again, this gave me a sort of a feeling of guilt. In a way, it felt that perhaps because of my aunt that the virus spread from my manuscript to humanity.
So we have you to blame. So the plague obviously dominates the center of the novel, but in many ways, the plague is really just a catalyst that kind of sets off this powder keg that is Mingaria. That's working through a number of different conflicts: modernity and tradition, science and religion, nationalism, authoritarianism.
Yes, the novel is about plague. As you said, plague triggers many things. But then these things were already there. They don't change. It dramatizes, intensifies what is already there. In the end, if you ask me, yes, now that we have coronavirus, we are talking about pandemic all the time, and the news and the media is highlighting it. But I would define my novel or talk about it, describe my novel as a sort of an panoramic fresco picture of the declining years of Ottoman Empire, how incapable of its bureaucracy is, how out of time they were, and obvious, inevitable disintegration of the Ottoman Empire. And of course, we don't stop there. Then it's also a sort of an allegorical novel, a general statement about the rise of the new nations from the ashes of the empire. We all know about these new nations. If you go to university sociology first year, what is a nation is based on: language, religion, geography, history, shared trauma, and so forth and so on. So it's also an allegory of a nation. Another aspect that when you live in an empire, when you live in a medieval system, the king or padishah or kaiser, the sultan, has godly attributes. He's a sort of a shadow of the god. But when it all falls apart, when the person who is a shadow, the ruler, the king, disappears, then you have to have new secret mythologies. My book also follows these. Little events that happened in the, 250th page are now, at the end of the book, raised to secular national myths. I cared about writing this because I live in a secular country, and everyone, and I is proud to have killed the godly Padishah. But then that Devi still, without knowing it, believe in secular myths. This book is also about the invention of secular myths that make a nation. Now that when the king disappears, people used to die for their king, not for the flag, not for the land, not for the blood, not for the Turkishness or Germanness, but you would die for your king. But when the Sultan is not there anymore with the godly shadow, then you have to invent new myths, secular myths. They will be secular, nationalistic myths to motivate people, to give them meaning to their lives, motivate them so that they kill the other one. You know, you used to kill other people for your king. Now you have to kill the other people for the nation, for the flag.
I loved I was a little surprised that this novel was as funny as it was. I wasn't expecting a novel about the plague to be so funny. And one of my favorite moments as you're talking about the flag here was the moment of the revolution when the major who becomes the commander waves the flag that was actually the advertisement for the personal care products and not, in fact, the Turkish flag or not, in fact, the Hungarian flag.
Okay, you know, it's not the book has intense irony. I don't know how. And in fact, I was writing the book, and my wife comes every night from her work. Then this is our ritual. I read to her whatever I read every day. In fact, she's sometimes like a stool teacher. Okay, I'm marking you, your page here, so that after she comes back, she sees how much I wrote. Anyway, and then one day I just, you know, horrors are happening here. And then, unfortunately, it's also reflected in the world. Then I'm cracking joke after joke, and we're laughing at it. Do you think people think that I'm heartless? I'm a cruel person. When so many people, and she used to say, go on, please continue write.
This novel, you know, as ironic and humorous as it is, this has gotten you in a bit of trouble in Turkey.
Yes, now that you said flag, one of the reasons that I was in trouble, that I knew that since I'm writing a national story of a rise of a nation and the founder of the nation, the national myth, that I knew that some people would mistake my one of the main characters with the Turkish president, founder of Turkish Republic, Kemal Atatürk. So I made it very clear that this person, physically, by character, by his history, by the way he married, by anything, do not resemble him. But anyway, I have so many enemies, political, so they wrote so much about this in the major newspapers that I was invited by the public press prosecutor. There is something like a person called public press prosecutor, that if you write something that the government doesn't like, then you're invited. So I testified, and then in the end, the conversation boiled down to what page, sir? Then there was no page. And according to my lawyer, who is a very experienced person, 10 years older than me, he says, don't worry, Mr. Pamuk, don't worry. Nothing will happen. I also agree. Don't worry. Nothing will happen.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that, and I think about all of the political strife around art and writing and literature right now. We were chatting a little bit backstage about book banning in the United States. I'm thinking, too, about the really tragic situation with Salman Rushdie not too long ago. And you've been very vocal about the position of the writer in the world, about kind of your role on a national political stage.
Okay, but they're really different situations. It's hard to generalize. And what I see, and my information is limited, in the United States, communities pressure the schools. While in Turkey, it's the top authoritarian legal authority bans the book. And when it's banned, it's illegal all over the country. While here, it's a local political matter. But on the other hand, there is some resemblance. First of all, I care about free speech. It's for me, the most important thing, value for me. But the resemblance is that maybe the public prosecutor or the journalists who were writing against me, hoping that the public prosecutor writes something, was inviting that, not that I'll be sent to jail, maybe that is also not too far, too much, but it will be reported in the newspapers. My books are read in the also high schools. So if a well-meaning high school teacher wants the students to read my book, the other one will say, "Wow, this guy is just insulted our founder of our republic, or just insulted our flag," so forth and so on. So these things, I also think, that part of a cultural political war. I don't know what to choose. Small communities pressuring high schools, or one big authority banning. They are horrible in its own way.
Mm-hmm. But you've never stopped writing. You've never seemed to be, even with the political pressure in Turkey, you've never stopped writing. You don't seem to be particularly afraid.
Yeah, one thing of course, I'm a writer. I should continue. What do? I should convert to doing something else? Then another thing that, besides this novel, I was never in trouble for my novels. That I was always ended up making with my comments, with my interviews, with my political writings, I was in trouble for that stuff. But not, I'm writing a novel, suddenly I wouldn't end in jail. But this time, again, nothing happened. But for the first time, public prosecutor invited me to testify.
I was really interested, just to change the subject a little, I was really interested in some of these conflicts in the novel around religion, not only in terms of the scales of the secular myths that people create, but the ways in which the individual communities on the island were kind of forming and reforming around their religious beliefs, particularly in response to scientific beliefs. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about...
Yes. Okay, let me describe what's happening in the novel a bit. This is like many Greek Ottoman Greek islands, which is half or some part of the population is Orthodox Greek, and some part is Muslim, and there is not much communication with them. They live in separate parts of the island, and as it was in the Ottoman island, Greeks were more in business and communication. They already had their independent modern Greek state in 1828, I think, and they were hoping the Greek population wants to join Greece, and the Turkish population wants to continue to be part of Ottoman Empire. But they don't kill each other, but both parties have their also guerrillas or terrorists or the Ottoman state slightly backing, of course, the Muslims. There is this enmity and hate, or sometimes peaceful situations. Yes, the pandemic, as you said, triggers them. And since this is a general picture of the Ottoman Empire, it is involved here. But on the other hand, that I wouldn't say this novel, and I also personally do not agree about the representing of such a situation, is there are the positivists, people who believe in science, and there are medieval, stupid, backward people who believe in religion. That I think we all have these spurs, religious beliefs, mystical beliefs, and a positivistic, scientific, reasonable thinking simultaneously at the same time in our minds. Mm-hmm. For example, I drew a portrait of a peasant-like sheikh who writes magic kind of religious little papers so that will keep you away from the plague, right? Mm-hmm. This I have seen in so many books about Islam and plague, that this kind of magic texts were given by the sheikhs, peasant, the religious authorities to people first. Then when I see something, when I write about it, people actually know the doctors are better than these guys, but there were no doctors around. It's not that stupidity or old-fashioned beliefs of the people, but there are no doctors around. Yes, in 1905, only 5% of the Ottoman Empire knew how to read and write. No one knew about the microbes or viruses at that time. So you also understand that. But on the other hand, this peasant like sheikh, when he gives a magical text, also gets some money from the helpless peasant so that he will, you know, put it here, look at like this, if you do this and pray this five times, the plague will not touch you, whatever. Then the sheikh social distances himself from the peasant. That is, actually, he doesn't believe, he believes in science. So I'm that kind of writer, that it's the joy of writing a book is not dividing humanity into blacks and whites, that blacks and whites are in all our heads. That it's because of that it's very hard to fight back, because you also, without knowing it, believe in religion or science or both simultaneously. Mm. This is my way of thinking in literature.
You know, one of the figures that looms over this novel is Sherlock Holmes. And that so neatly, I think, the figure of Sherlock Holmes, I should back up, one reason why, or one of the kind of central stories in this novel is a murder mystery, is Princess Pakise and her husband, Prince Consort Dr. Nuri, are sent to the island to solve a murder. And part of the question is whether or not we do this the Sherlock Holmes way, which is partly about inductive reasoning.
Okay.
Which is a scientific method. And yet at the same time, they're not trying to solve this murder by calling on the ghost of Isaac Newton, right? They're calling on a literary figure, someone that ignites imagination, something that is, in many ways, Sherlock Holmes has risen to the level of a secular myth as well.
Okay, first of all, the hidden hero of my novel is Abdulhamid II, a sort of a Turkish Queen Victoria, because he reigned so much, so long, and although he was a repressive, politically repressive person, he closed Turkish parliament, Ottoman parliament, but he was also interested in science, bringing Western science, paid a lot of money to Western doctors. He had a taste for opera, and he had a taste for reading detective novels. And when he was introduced to early stories of Sherlock Conan Doyle, and was very much affected by him. There are personal parallels with him in the methods of Sherlock Holmes and Abdulhamid. Abdulhamid, because he was a bit paranoid, did rarely left his palace. He didn't go to his Ottoman Empire, never traveled around. And because of that, he photographed, and he was a great admirer of art of photography. He photographed his empire, and these albums are kept in Istanbul Library. Partly I also wrote my novel looking at these albums. But Abdulhamid and Sherlock Holmes resembled each other because Sherlock Holmes also do not go to the... Watson brings him the information, and he is sitting at his table and reasoning. Abdulhamid, this is my imagination. It's a fact that everyone knows, there are books about this in Turkey, that Abdulhamid was infatuated by detective fiction, and his diplomatical translators were also busy translating French, a lot of French, but a few English detective writers, and this was the period of railroads, telegraph, and detective novels all went simultaneously at the same time. Abdulhamid admired him, perhaps because I argue that the way Sherlock Holmes reasoned and worked alone in an office, information is coming to him, and he is deducing, making a decision all the time. He was a hard worker. This was interesting for me in one way. Another thing, of course, is the traditional medieval Ottoman European way of solving the murder mystery is not Sherlock Holmes' method, is just you beat a lot of the suspects, then some of them confesses that, yes, I did it, sir, then you don't need Sherlock Holmes reasoning. The irony of the book is that Abdulhamid, or life is not, my book is only putting, reflecting, is that he enjoys Sherlock Holmes, invited him. These are real facts. Sherlock Holmes, when he, Conan Doyle, when he had second marriage, just after his second marriage, was invited to Istanbul by Abdulhamid. He came to Istanbul, and in fact, he was going to meet Abdulhamid, but he was too curious to visit Yıldız Palace, the palace where Abdulhamid lived, and perhaps his advisors told Abdulhamid that this English writer may put your palace in his next novel, sir. So he declined to meet him, gave a medal to Conan Doyle, and his secondary, third medal to his wife, and never saw them. But just like in My Name is Red, there is also a philosophical thinking deep, perhaps that's what I'm thinking, that, you know, there's a murder mystery there, then it's also related to individuality that I argued in that book, that what we call today style is not a deliberate choice, but it's something, a mistake you do without knowing, then they detect you, or then they find you, you have a style. And if you're self-conscious about it, you continue with that style. But it's a mistake. Actually, in medieval art, they wanted you to be a color photocopy maker. But some people cannot do it. They have individuality and style. And also the murderer with that style, you leave your mark. And the murderer with that makes a mistake and he leaves his mark. That was the philosophical conceit in My Name is Red. Here is that Abdulhamid wants Western methods. They are so attractive, thinking, putting human reasoning on a pedestal and conquering, running the world with that logic. But unfortunately, he has to use force. Also, that is parallel to what epidemiologists do during my plague or during this coronavirus, that the smart doctor do not go from street to street, back streets, but stays at his office or whatever and looks at the numbers and graphs and reasons, and his reasoning is stronger than the reasoning of the doctor who is talking with the patients, so forth and so on. And looking at the geographical map and looking at the numbers, you can stop the epidemic in this way rather than force or quarantine. Or, of course, quarantine is necessary. But the book is also partly about, and these were the years, as I said, railroads, then soon electricity. So many new developments were being done, and humanity was getting this optimism that human intellect and reasoning is so powerful that we will overrun, we will run the world, while on the other hand, that there are also inevitable inner contradictions to this kind of thinking, because not everyone believes what you do, not everyone follows your scientific reasoning. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of style, I loved the descriptions of Mingaria, right? This fictional place that you've invented.
It's a beautiful place. I've been there.
So I had to ask, you know, after Museum of Innocence, you've created this museum. Is this just your ploy to buy an island?
No. But, of course, it's based on real islands. That it most resembles the island of Crete, of the Greek Republic. I've been there. I liked it. It's also very southern. I like it, that climate. I also want to live there. You know, one reason we're novelists write a novel, because we invent such a detailed, such an intricate world that in the end you convince yourself that you're living there, because you have to convince that you are living there so that your characters behave accordingly, behave naturally in this atmosphere. A novelist is a person who really believes in his dreams, really believes in his vision, so that if you don't believe in your vision, your readers will not believe it at all, and your characters would not be consistent. So writing a novel for 4 years is living in an imaginary place. Whether it's real or not, that's not that important, because with your style, you make it your with your own. So it's, in many ways, an average Mediterranean island, partly based on the real island of Crete. A second one is Castello Rizzo, one of the most eastern place of Republic of Greece, happens to be half a mile away from the one of the most southern place of Turkey. And every year I used to go there in the month of May so that I welcome summer and begin swimming before summer comes to Istanbul. And it was half a mile away from me, so I used to look at that island all the time writing novels, even this novel, and then occasionally once a month go there and visit. So small. That is a second example. But more important example, all of my life during the summers, I lived in Princess Islands, one of the Princess Islands in the last 10 years in Principe, and there were horse-drawn carriages till 2 years ago. So there are horse-drawn carriages in Mingeria, and they're copied from real life.
I mean, it was, I'm sure I speak for everyone who's had the pleasure of reading the novel. I mean, it was so immersive, the descriptions of the island, but then also the intricacy of the history that gets unspooled through digression after digression. I heard Jason mention Borges before we came out, and it felt very Borgesian to me in many moments.
You know, you said Borgesian, yes, and it's also a Tolstoyan novel. Uh-huh. I sometimes said, there was a questionnaire, I think, in an English newspaper, what are the writers you admire? I said, it just came out of me, Borges and Tolstoy. And I immediately realized that all of my life, I tried to combine Borges and Tolstoy in Istanbul. My work is, and every book is an attempt to be both Borgesian and Tolstoyan and set the story in Istanbul or my part of the world. What do I like? Okay. First of all, Borges never understood Tolstoy. That's the funny part. I never hear that Borges ever mentioned. Borges is a great intellect. I really influenced by him, admire him so much, but he never understood what we read novels for, never understood a novel. For him, a novel is its plot, its storyline. He confesses this indirectly when he says, you know, I'm going to tell you a story. If it was Henry James, it will be 600 pages. Now I'll tell in 6 pages. Well, we don't read Mr. Borges. I like you so much, but we don't read novels for its summary. We develop sentiments. We enjoy, and it's an immense pleasure to be able to identify with someone and see the world from his or that someone's point of view, from the eyes of that person. I think we enjoy, I wouldn't say literature, poetry is not like that, but novels is an attempt to jump into consciousness, point of view of other people, and that makes the world more interesting. How, and there is always the other, someone, and they are always, the drama of life is other people are so different, mm-hmm. you know, and then there are people are different because of class, gender, history. Then we want to jump to the consciousness, to the visions of these other people. That's why we read novels, not because of the acrobatics of the storyline, which Borges was interested in.
Well, and then I hope some of my students are here, because that was just the most beautiful manifesto for novel reading that I've heard in some time. We'll move on to questions and take some questions from the audience. I know we've got some staff members in the back with microphones, but if anyone has a question for Mr. Pamuk, I'm happy to moderate that.
You mentioned Museum of Innocence, and I had a question about that. A few years ago, I attended an exhibit of the objects from Museum of Innocence in Oslo. Can you tell us more about the museum? Is it still functioning? And can we expect an exhibit in Philadelphia?
Thank you. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I can talk endlessly about the Museum of Innocence. That, first of all, it's that I there is a Museum of Innocence, a novel, and there is also a museum with that name. In the museum, I'm telling this to people who do not know about it, in the museum, oh, it's a love story. In the museum, all the things that these lovers had touched, all the things that the story described, all the visions, pictures, photos, and daily life things are exhibited with some logic. The novel has 83 chapters, and the museum is supposed to have 83, I think we have 75 or something, vitrines or somehow Joseph Cornell-like or somehow different than boxes. I wrote the museum and simultaneously, I wrote the book and simultaneously I built the museum. It's not that one day I have a very popular novel and then why don't I do a museum of it? The logic of the museum is explained in the novel. Even it's poetic. Even, in fact, towards the end of the book, the novel, the main character builds a museum, the Museum of Innocence. In fact, I was planning to open the museum the day the book is published, or the book will be published the day the museum opened. That I couldn't do because, you know, we are making a museum is making art decisions, buying art things, this or that, but there is also building a building. And we all know the carpenter never comes on time. The painter comes next week, not next week, but next month. So it was delayed and delayed. And my friends told me, why don't you publish the book? Maybe you make more money. And then finish the in between, in fact, that I won a Nobel Prize. So it was easy to finish with that money. Then I opened the museum 10 years ago. In fact, this September, I added another 6 new vitrines and did a big press conference. Our numbers are very good, that the museum is running on its own. I'm not putting any money at the beginning. I put my it's based, made with my money. It's a foundation now, but the number of people are increasing and increasing. So the museum is doing fine. If you come to Istanbul, you know, there are websites, the touristic destinations in Istanbul, Saint Sophia, Blue Mosque, and we are in the top 10. Tourists are coming. I'm very happy with my museum. Please, when you come to Istanbul, visit this. Thank you for giving me this opportunity for advertisement.
Some good SpawnCon.
And that made me also interested in museums, and wherever I go, I visit museums.
Did you go to the Motor Museum?
Oh, yes, I was there. Unfortunately, they don't allow you to take photos. The pretext that we'll want to be respectful to people whose skulls we are exhibiting. That is respectful, but me taking photos is disrespectful. Is, I think, a contradiction. It's an interesting museum, really. And then they also don't allow you to take photos, but they're also selling photo books of the museum. It's an interesting place, but, you know, in that kind of museum, the irony is not intended. That it resembles cabinets of curiosities in many ways, but then these objects were not produced to be part of a cabinet of curiosities. Mm-hmm. That I also think that surrealists also did things like that. That there is an parallel between surrealism and ethnography, anthropology. Well, that is also a bit strange, to say the least. I am fascinated by Mutter Museum very much because the intentions of the collector and the intentions of the visitor do not overlap there. The artsiness that honors the museum, that makes the museum, quote, beautiful, is contradictory. So perhaps because of these feelings of guilt, they are only punishing the photographers to hide these contradictions, I think.
So you mentioned Istanbul. I recently read your memoir, Istanbul, which was such a wonderful weave of personal memoir and about the city.
Thank
that
you.
Made me want to visit Istanbul. And it left off, of course, well, not of course, but it left off as you decide to become a writer. It made me want to...
Oh, thank you for saying so. I have plans to write its continuation. But the continuation would not be Istanbul Volume 2. In fact, I planned but did not execute. I probably wrote one chapter but stopped because I'm looking for photos. Istanbul book recipe for that book is threefold. The first, my autobiography till the age of 22, comma, a general thinking about living in a city and identifying with it, and also all the travelers wrote about that city, and black and white photos that correspond to the feeling that the book conveys. Now, with that recipe, with that formula, I am thinking, in fact, three other books. I am started writing the second one, which will be the title, East-West, the parentheses, a memoir. Everything that I have experienced between, about changing of culture, this or that, I would write personally. But just like in Istanbul, I will also write about things that happened 100 years before me, but what we can generally refer to as cultural change, reading habits. And some of these things are very visible. Some of them are very hard to find. Turks used to all sleep on the ground at night, and in the morning you wake up, you roll your bed, and put it on a cupboard, and there are no, what we today know as beds on furniture. But in 200 years, without any involvement, not even Kemal Atatürk or Ottoman Sultan made a bed reform, that Turks slowly and slowly removed the, while in still some parts of Turkey, in eastern Turkey, they still continue to sleep on a mattress put on a floor. Then in the morning, making up the bed is the person rolls it, then puts in a bed. Then when the night comes, there's a Turkish saying, shall I put the bed on? Shall I open the bed, meaning unroll? For example, this is such a cultural change. More, I even wrote about this earlier in my book, The White Castle, that Turks used to eat on floor and write on floor. If you see the characters in My Name Is Red, all these scriveners, when you want to see one of them, they are sitting on a floor and doing a painting, right? Mm-hmm. They're bent with, what do you call this? Your legs are crossed, yes. But then, in another 250 years, not only Turks, but whole my part of the world stopped eating on floor and moved to the table. There was not a one dramatical day, and whenever I say it, when I talk to my friends about my books, whenever I say, oh, they still didn't eat in sleep on the floor and eat on floor in Eastern Anatolia, they say yes. So I want to write about these kind of cultural changes or toilet habits, for example. The only chapter I wrote about that book, the second volume, I also thought about the third and fourth volumes, but I won't tell you that, a strange subject, but I should address it, is the toilet habits, that the Turkish traditional toilet was entirely different than European or American toilet. Now, 90% of the Turks are also using Europe, but there was not one dramatical thing. Also, what Turks refer to as clean or not clean, this is based on Quran. because I started writing this book now that you ask. I'm talking too much, maybe, but I'm telling you a book that I'm not even planning to finish in the coming 2 years, but I started writing that book too, is Jean-Luc Godard has a book, a film called Hate, based on Alberto Moravio's book, in which Brigitte Bardot, Jack Palance, and Michel Piccoli was playing, and in which Michel Piccoli and Brigitte Bardot are husband and wife. Michel Piccoli is trying to make money. They're arguing and arguing, and they filled the bathtub. And this is summer. First, Michel Piccoli takes a bath. Then, without changing the water, Brigitte Bardot says, are you finished? And she goes into the bath. And as soon as this happened, I was in an upper-class Nishantashi, where most of my novels are set. The whole audience, civilized, westernized audience, said, woo! They hated it. Because although they are westernized, it is very unclean and not religious or not good, not even civilized for a Turk, that you can only wash yourself with a moving water. But if you enter that in a tube where someone else entered and cleaned himself, it makes you even dirtier. And it's your idea of cleanliness, which is also ablutions in Islam, is related to that. So I wanted to write a book, but while on the, I'm not saying that now Turks are using the same water, but I want to write about all of these minor things. Another one was this, if you have time. But my father worked for a Turkish gas company, you know, in tubes. And in 1960s, he was in young age CEO of a Turkish company, which later developed to sell more of these tubes, which liquid tube, that they invented chicken grill machines where chickens are turning around. Mm-hmm. And döner, in 50s, döner kebab, which is not as famous as pizza here, was not even famous by the Turks. But once my father's company invented these tubes, suddenly this old traditional Turkish döner, no one cared about döner, suddenly got very popular. There are many, many, many hundreds of thousands of kiosks all over Turkey where you can sell döner, because now you don't need a coal, you don't need patience. It's very practical, turn out to be, to eat and consume traditional Turkish food, which was very rare thing that you do in the ceremonies and exceptional things, suddenly very popular. Then add another 30 years, all these Turks immigrated to Germany. And now it's a main dish in Germany, döner. So you see how I want to follow these things, not revolutions, dramas, military coups, or this or that, but how you eat, how you sleep, how you sit on a table, how you think, how you clean yourself. Yes, there will be a second volume, and it will be East-West, a memoir. And there will be also photos. I'm collecting these photos to finish the book. But it's very hard to find people sleeping on the floor. They never photographed themselves like that.
Back to islands. So your island reminded me of the work of Javier Marías, the Spanish novelist who died recently, who created a whole island and populated it with a whole hierarchy of people. Like,
yeah, he also made me some. He also gave me an aristocratic.
He gave you a title too.
But he didn't invent. He really had an island on paper.
Yes, he did. He owned it. Yeah, sorry.
One of the members of the aristocracy of that island.
I'm glad to know there's a connection. That's what I was going to ask. Thank you.
And you appear in the closing pages of this book as well.
Sorry?
You appear in this novel as well.
Yeah, but that's not important. It's like the value of Hitchcock's films wouldn't change if he hadn't appeared in them. But we like him for doing that, right?
I'm going to reread this with the Hitchcock lens now.
I don't know if this should be the last question, but I wanted to ask about freedom of speech in Turkey. And I had the pleasure of interviewing you in 2006 after you left Turkey. I interviewed you at Deutsche House. And my question is about Article 301 and...
Sorry, the question is?
About Article 301, about freedom of speech, and can you write anything there? What's happening with writers in Turkey right now?
Okay, there's no free speech in Turkey. You don't need Article 301 because there is no legal, believable, trustable legal system in Turkey that there is one major authority, Erdogan, and whoever he wants to put into prison, he puts into prison. That legality, unfortunately, is not cared about. No one cares about constitution. On the other hand, that it's not writers or in the forefront, but it's they are the journalists whose job is to daily criticize Erdogan end up in jail. In fact, he controls all of the major newspapers and paper newspapers. Opposition is only in websites, but on the other hand, these websites are much, much, much more popular than the main newspapers. The biggest Turkish newspapers, really, in the number of copies distribution really disappeared because they are backing Erdogan. For this method, that method, Erdogan controls the major Turkish media. If you criticize him too much, especially 2 years ago, 3 years ago, you would, if a journalist, you would end up in jail. But on the other hand, all the polls are showing us that his popularity is dramatically going down, not unfortunately because of free speech, but because of the country is in a horrible economical shape that my people, my country, really went back to poverty. People cannot buy books, culture is not enjoyed, families are eating less. The economical prospect is really horrible, especially in the ruling government was really damaging democracy, free speech, respect to human rights for the last 10 years or 8 years. But for the last two and a half years, economy is in such a bad shape that, and the polls are also showing that, that maybe, unfortunately, majority of Turkish voters would not change their votes because this person or that person is put into jail, but they will change their votes because they are eating less, there is no prospect of future, and I don't think Erdogan will win the next elections if it's fair, and all the elections up to now was fair, but he may do invent things to postpone this or that, but in the end, I am not that pessimistic because of the polls, but maybe I'm a naive idiot cheating myself because the situation is so bad.
Which I think some of us can identify a little bit heading into midterms. thank you so much, Mr. Pamuk. It was so wonderful to speak to you. Thank you all for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.